Next item on the agenda is item five, Carol Davidson Reagan, docket 081349. Mr. McGinnis, good morning.
In the matter of Carol Davidson Reagan, the commission is reviewing on appeal by 26 Norfolk freeholders the October 8, 2008 decision by the Norfolk Wetland Board to approve a proposal to impact and fill vegetated tidal wetlands to accommodate the construction of a single-family residence, private driveway, utilities, and a 5-foot wide by 35-foot long elevated walkway adjacent to Ms. Regan's undeveloped non-riparian property situated along Edgewater Haven in the city of Norfolk. And just for orientation purposes, just want to help provide the commission idea of where this project is located. To the left of the screen here is the Elizabeth River. This is Norfolk International Terminals here, and this is the Lafayette River. Edgewater Haven is a tributary to the Lafayette, and her property is located here, approximately. Just an aerial photograph of subject site. You can see there the undeveloped piece in the middle. Just an oblique aerial shot here of the property. Again, and just a little bit close up, and that helps provide you a sense of where her property lies. This is a city right-of-way. It's undeveloped. It's the extension of this is Richmond Crescent here, and if the city were to ever develop that or had in the past wished to have, it would have extended along this bulkhead and connected over here. I believe this is Richmond Place that runs off the screen. But her property line extends from the edge of the city right-of-way back alongside this tree line to a point approximately back in here, across, and then back down. It's actually three separate lots that are 25 foot wide each. So let me back up for a second here. The proposal includes filling approximately 4,848 square feet of vegetated tidal wetlands, as well as temporary impacts to 1,210 square feet of vegetated tidal wetlands. And again, those are associated with the construction of the home, the driveway. The driveway would need to extend from this point here along within the city right-of-way and then come up into her property to meet the house, all of which would lie within those wetland areas. The proposal also includes on-site mitigation for a portion of the impacts, and that would be creating a wetland area by grading down the uppermost extent of her third lot, which lies to the west. The Norfolk Wetland Board considered the applicant's proposal at a public hearing on October 8, 2008. They took testimony not only from Ms. Regan, but her agent, Mr. Giorgio, both of whom are in attendance here today. They also took testimony from Ms. Nicole Sanford, Mr. James Sumner, and Mr. Ellis James, who spoke against the project. I believe Ms. Sanford and Ms. Sumner live adjacent to or nearby Ms. Regan's property. The conclusion of that hearing, the board voted 5-2 to approve the project as proposed, with an assessment of in-lieu fees to compensate for the remaining impacts not addressed by the proposed on-site mitigation plan. The board's approval, though, stipulated that revised drawings be submitted for any changes, increases, and or decreases to the impacts as a result of requirements from other city departments, and that the in-lieu fee assessment be adjusted accordingly. I'll get into that a little bit later, but there are other requirements by the cities, for instance, the Public Works Department, that if a development goes in on these areas, that the entire right-of-way must be developed, and that was discussed by the board. And could potentially increase the amount of impacts that are being proposed. Staff received a letter of appeal signed by 26 Norfolk freeholders on October 15, 2008. The appellants contend the board failed to fulfill its responsibilities under the Wetland Zoning Ordinance and that their decision to approve the project was unsupported by the evidence. I hate to do this, but I think it needs to be summarized in some manner, so I will go through the points that their letter made so that they are in the record. The actual points that are made are verbatim in the letter, which is item 2 in your books. Item 1, the project is not water dependent and should have therefore been denied based upon its failure to satisfy the criteria for water dependency as required under the Commission's Wetlands Mitigation Compensation Policy. Item 2, the project fails to identify all permanent impacts, including curbs, gutters, lighting, and drainage within the unimproved right-of-way, as could be required by the City's Department of Public Works for development of the property. Item 3, Section 28.2.1302 of the Code requires the Board to consider the impact of the project upon public health, safety, and welfare. A city fire inspector has indicated that the fire department may be unable to reach the proposed residence, placing additional risk on neighboring residences from the spread of fire or sparks. The existing vegetated wetlands on the Regan property act as a natural protective barrier against floods and tidal storms, which protect many of the surrounding residences, evidenced by the photographs presented at the hearing. Item 4, the board took into consideration and expressed empathy that the property taxes have been paid on the property for numerous years. There was an overwhelming amount of weight given to the issue of tax payment in comparison to the minimal amount placed on the regulation of wetland development. The applicant can file for a tax abatement with the city. Item 5, approval of the project sets a frightening precedent for all of Tidewater and shows an inconsistent stance on the environment by the city when considering the city's stewardship of the environment through such projects as the adjacent Larchmont Library Birdsong Wetland site. Excuse me. This also sets a precedent for development of additional undeveloped lots on either side of the applicant's property. Item 6, the board was appeased by the applicant's willingness to provide mitigation for the permanent loss of vegetated tidal wetlands, thus jeopardizing the ecological balance of the Edgewater Haven Lafayette River. Proposed on-site location for wetlands compensation, as proposed, will remain above the elevation that defines wetlands jurisdiction. The board also failed to consider total impact to wetlands as a result to the requirements to develop the entire Richmond Crescent right-of-way, paved to a width of 26 feet and impacting an additional 2,058 square feet of wetlands. The board appeared to minimize the credentials of their professional staff by ignoring their findings and instead placing the applicant's feelings and nostalgia for the property above the staff's findings. The appellant's letter went on to state there was an overwhelming evidence the proposed development should not have been approved by the board, as demonstrated by the assessments provided by the city staff as well as the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. They ask that the board's decision be reversed and that the application be denied since the board failed to fulfill its responsibilities under the Wetland Zoning Ordinance and the decision was not supported by the evidence. In addition to that letter with the attached signatures, we also received a letter from Mr. William R. Turner III. His letter is item 3 in your packets. And he is also one of the signatories on the appeal petition, but he submitted his own letter in support of that appeal. At the October 8, 2008 public hearing, city staff provided the Wetlands Board with a presentation of the proposed project, which included slides, a reading of the project's VIMS report, and their own staff assessment. I'll begin here in just 1 second to go through that. It is quite lengthy, and I'll try and go through as quickly as possible. But before I do that, I just wanted to make note that their assessment stated that the project was not consistent with the standards for permit issuance. And it went on to say that the wetlands in question were of primary ecological significance and are a valuable protective barrier against floods, tidal storms, and that residential housing is not a water-dependent use. On the basis of that latter point alone, the city staff informed the board that the commission's guidelines state that the project must be denied. So let me go ahead and begin that. Again, this is each of the slides that were presented to the board by their staff. with the black background here. This is just a map of the city, and again, the project is located approximately here. These are photographs here at the beginning from June of 2006. This is the property in question here, and just go through. This is a shot of the neighboring property to the west, and you can see they were mowing. This is likely wetlands vegetation that's being mowed here. This is within the city right-of-way, and you see the bulkhead runs along in this area through here. This is standing approximately out on Richmond Place, I believe, on the street. It's looking back to the street here. So her driveway is proposed would need to come down right through here. And this is all being mowed right now, but as evidenced by the site visits conducted by the city and VEMS, as well as BMRC staff, there were wetland vegetation on site. Now these photographs going to a cheat sheet that was in the record from the city staff here. I believe these photographs are actually from May of 2007 here, and they actually show that Ms. Regan's property was being mowed at the time. It's a little difficult to identify wetlands vegetation when you're constantly mowing that, and that's one of the points that the city was trying to make here. This is looking west. This is the neighbor's property to the west. You'll see that house in many of the photographs. This is within the city right-of-way, and this is the pier that is associated with the Regan property. This is from 2007, but currently it's in a deteriorated fashion and would need to be replaced if she were to be able to develop this property. And even though that is within the city right-of-way, the city does usually issue encroachment permits for private piers. It's a standard practice in the city. These are actually more recent photographs taken in September here. And this is the staked alignment through here. You can actually see, I believe, where the proposed driveway would need to be coming in at. And you can see here that the city is maintaining their right-of-way with that wetland vegetation. This is a shot from, again, the same September 15th date. Some of these photographs here that are mixed in do not have a date in the corner. They're actually taken on September 19th here. This pole represents the upper limit of wetlands jurisdiction in this particular part of Norfolk, which happens to be the 2.69 contour. Elevation contour, and you can see the bulkhead and the water are actually out here, so wetlands jurisdiction extends all the way up onto the property to this point, and you see salt bushes and other wetland vegetation in this area here. I think there's just vaguely a stake here, so that upper limit comes right through here. That's the state of her current pier. This is actually on the adjacent street, Richmond Place, I believe. This was on September 19th, and you can actually see here that the water was high enough that day that the storm water actually backed up, and the tidal water was actually flowing in. You could actually see the flow moving up the street. So this area does get inundated quite often. Again, the same date, September 19th. This is looking onto the adjacent property to the west here. And you can see there was water here almost 6 inches deep if you walked around through that. These photographs were provided, I believe, by Ms. Sanford. The date here listed, it was May 4th, 2007, so another high water event. And you can see ducks are taking use of the Regan property there, which at the time was being mowed, it looks like. Just have been a little bit later in the day. can see the water. I mean, it looks like it's coming right up to the back of the Sanford property here. This photograph and several of the preceding were apparently taken on September 24th, 2008. Unfortunately, there's blurry, but this, I believe, is some of the adjacent streets around the area here that you can see some of the flooding. Many of those who testified, against the project at the hearing, stated that this was fairly typical of really any high water event, particularly during any storm event, that they would have water in this area. Again, here's those stakes again. This was that upper limit of wetlands jurisdiction, and you can see, water clearly all the way up into here. This is a copy of the project drawings that were marked up by staff. And Kathy, it might be helpful to turn off the lights just to be able to see this a little bit better. Let's see here. The three lots that Ms. Regan owns are these three here. This is the right-of-way extending from this point to the bulkhead here, the Richmond Crescent right-of-way. And what they're proposing, and what Ms. Regan's proposing, is a driveway that would extend through this area of the right-of-way and turn up into her property. Proposed residence will be located on two of her three lots, and the upper limit of wetlands jurisdiction, that 2.69 contour you can see, is located here. This is the line that was surveyed in, and you can see, based upon that, over 60% of the proposed house footprint is located within vegetated tidal wetlands, and the entire driveway up to this point here where the 2.69 contour crosses would also be located within tidal wetlands. Going back to the earlier point about the requirements that may be put on Ms. Regan by the city's Public Works Department, that if she were to be required to develop the entire right-of-way, that would be the full width of the right-of-way, street, paved street, gutters, lighting, and so forth, I believe, are the requirements that were stated in the by the city. And that there's an email, I believe, in your packets that describes those requirements. This is just a cross-section of the house here. It is pile-supported, but there is fill proposed over that. Provide for a garage underneath, and then there's just a cross section here of the proposed pier or walkway extension that they're showing. This is a cross section of the proposed mitigation site, and let me go back and highlight that for you. On this third lot that she owns here, 2.69 contour, which is the upper limit, crosses right here. They are proposing to grade down the remaining southern portion of that lot to create tidal wetlands. There was some discussion as to what that the actual square footage was. I believe that Mr. Giorgio, Ms. Regan's agent, had calculated that it was over 900 square feet of wetlands that would be created, which does not meet the total impact, but may offset it some. City staff actually looked at that and believed that there was actually less, somewhere in the neighborhood of 570 to 600 square feet, and that was based upon their belief that the side slopes, the elevations were too high and would not count as being within that boundary for upper limit of wetlands. So, the markings in red here on this drawing, as well as the two preceding drawings, were made by city staff. Just as a comparison, this is an adjacent site. This is the Birdsong Wetland site. This was presented to the board as part of the hearing. This is the Larchmont Library, Hampton Boulevard, just out of sight here. But they showed that this site back in 1997, according to this date, that the similar circumstance where you had a concrete bulkhead, there was wetland vegetation present behind that, and the city staff wanted to show that, you know, that these wetland areas can be restored back and, you know, to have a higher value than what they currently have, which, according to their opinion on Ms. Regan's property, that they were extremely valuable. But this is just pictures of the site. This is after the portions of the bulkhead removed, and that area was actually planted with spartina grasses and everything, so you had a wider variety of wetland vegetation at that site. And Ms. Regan's property is located just to the left off the screen within the same cove off Edgewater Haven. Virginia Institute of Marine Science the VIMS report for the project stated the project was not water dependent and that filling wetlands to create uplands is undesirable pursuant to the Commission's wetlands guidelines. VIMS classified the wetlands vegetation on Ms. Regan's property as a salt meadow community or type 2 wetlands. The report went on to remind the board of the criteria that must be met in order for the project to be approved. Following the staff presentation, the applicant's agent, Mr. Giorgio, provided an overview of the proposed project, and he also presented several slides here, which include the white background here. I'll get to those in just a second. His overview included a brief historical background, the slides, which I'll show you in a second. And Mr. Giorgio had argued that the project was maintained as a mowed lawn for many years. So let me get into some of these photographs. This is a recent photograph similar to what the City of Norfolk staff had provided. Looks very similar. These are all recent 2008 photographs. But this photograph from 1979, and there are several others, show that property, which back at the time was the backyard of Ms. Regan's childhood home, from my understanding, that the home that Ms. Sanford now lives in was the home that Ms. Regan had lived in at the time, and that this was an adjoining piece of property to that they used as a backyard. Obviously, it was mowed, and Mr. Giorgio argued that it was maintained as a lawn, which he described as being Bermuda grass, which from these photographs would be hard to discern, but it's his contention. And that wetlands did not previously exist on this site until the City of Norfolk in 1999. They planted wetlands vegetation within their right-of-way after having done maintenance work on their bulkhead. Mr. Giorgio also presented the board with City of Norfolk tax assessments, trying to show that Ms. Regan's property, as well as several adjacent developed and undeveloped lots, were being taxed as buildable lots, not as unbuildable. Mr. Giorgio also questioned whether the wetlands on this site were of primary ecological value and stated that, in his opinion, that the wetlands were a lesser valued saltbush community, type 4 wetland, rather than the salt meadow community, type 2, identified by VIMS. Mr. Giorgio went on during the hearing to discuss water dependency and said that the City of Norfolk staff was taking the Commission's mitigation policy out of context. He believed that the Commission's policy was not intended to address impacts resulting from the development of residential properties, rather just shoreline stabilization structures, and the accumulation of those minor losses from those types of structures, rather than the larger impacts from constructing a residential house. Mr. Giorgio also stated that not allowing Ms. Regan to develop this property would constitute a taking. The board then took testimony from several people who were in objection to the project. Ms. Nicole Sanford, who owns the property, as I just mentioned, just behind this spoke and had said that she was concerned about the potential for increased flooding and the loss of the natural vegetated buffer, which separates her property from Edgewater Haven. Ms. Sanford provided printed photographs of several recent flood events as a result of storms and higher than average tides. Some of those photographs, I believe, were that she had taken were presented by staff, but there are also several others that she actually presented as handouts to the board that are in your books. I believe that's item 6H, Roman numeral 9. Mr. James Sumner, a nearby property owner, also spoke against the project and echoed Ms. Sanford's comments. They had both also stated that Ms. Reagan should seek a tax abatement from the city to recoup those portions of the taxes paid on the property assessed as a buildable rather than unbuildable lot. Mr. Ellis W. James, a Norfolk resident, stated that Norfolk staff had not taken the commission's mitigation criteria out of context and urged the board to reject the application. The applicant, Ms. Regan, also testified before the board. She stated that she was disturbed to hear that her property referred to as wetlands and that any wetlands on her property are a result to the work the city had done in the late 90s. Following those public comments, Norfolk staff had returned before the board and had presented the board with several items of discussion, the first of which was that the city had provided the board with a copy of a court case decision related to W.B. Hall Jr. et al. Versus the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. I believe this is from 1984, and a copy of which is in your book as item 6H, Roman numeral 2. This was a case that had similar circumstances and was actually denied by the Virginia Beach Wetland Board. That denial was appealed to the commission. The commission upheld the Virginia Beach Wetland Board in that case. The commission's decision to uphold that was then appealed to the Second Judicial Circuit. And in that case, the court ruled that that not just wetlands of primary ecological significance deserve protection by wetland boards, and that the decision to deny the permit was supported by the evidence, was not arbitrary and capricious, and that it achieved the goals of the Wetlands Act, and that it also did not constitute an unconstitutional taking of property. Regardless of that decision, though, city staff went on to state that they disagreed with Mr. Giorgio's assertions that the wetlands on Ms. Regan's property were not Type 1 wetlands, and that wetland grasses such as Spartina patens and Distichelys spicata were present on the footprint of the house and driveway area proposed to be permanently impacted. They went on to state that Mr. Giorgio was correct and that the commission's wetland mitigation compensation policy does not specifically address development of residential housing because that type of development is clearly does not meet the standard for water dependency. Board continued discussing the project and was reminded by their deputy city attorney who sits as counsel to the board on the criteria that must be met in order for the board to grant or deny a permit. Board member Jim Giannata stated on the record that he was concerned about setting a precedent for this type of development on similar properties. Following that, board member Robinson stated that he had visited the site and that if possible, the project should be minimized. He followed up that comment, though, by moving to approve the project as proposed without any consideration for minimizing the impacts. And again, as was stated earlier in our staff assessment, that motion included the condition that essentially allows the impacts to increase based upon the requirements of other city departments. That approval also included the assessment of in-lieu fees at a rate of $12 per square foot for all impacts that exceed the amount of on-site mitigation that was proposed. The motion was seconded. Discussion also continued after that. where Board Member McCrory had stated that the project as presented was unacceptable, but that with the requirement for in-lieu fees, that he stated that it was doable. Mr. McCrory's statement effectively reflects that he allowed the mitigation to justify his approval of the project, contrary to the explicit requirement against doing so in the Commission's wetland mitigation compensation policy. A vote was taken and the motion passed 5-2. And let me just quickly run through the rest of these slides that Mr. Giorgio had presented before I get into our summary and recommendation. Again, just similar photos, 1982 here showing it as a mowed lawn all the way right up to the bulkhead here, 1986. Sometime in the early 1990s, and you can see this is the pier here that was shown in other photographs that was part of the Regan property there. And these are photographs from January of 1999 when the city was doing the work on the bulkhead, and this is where they had contended that the city had come in and actually introduced wetland vegetation by planting this, which I believe is a fact that the city did plant vegetation within their right-of-way, but I don't believe there was any evidence presented that showed the city came in and adjusted the elevations on Ms. Regan's property to allow wetland vegetation to encroach onto that. So now I'll read our staff summary and recommendation. Staff strongly disagrees with Mr. Giorgio's contention that the requirements of the Commission's Wetlands Mitigation Compensation Policy do not apply to the development of residential homes within tidal wetlands. Staff drafted the language in the revised policy for Commission adoption and specifically mentioned its application to shoreline stabilization structures, since those are typically considered permissible uses in tidal wetlands, whereas the construction of a residence is clearly non-water dependent and cannot demonstrate the need to be within tidal wetlands and would therefore be an impermissible use in tidal wetlands. The policy is in no way intended to be exclusive to shoreline stabilization structures and should be applied to all proposals to develop jurisdictional tidal wetlands. Staff agrees with the appellants and the city staff that the existing wetlands located within the city's right-of-way and Ms. Regan's property provide a valuable buffer against flooding and tidal storms for the surrounding neighborhood and Ms. Regan's own upland property. When considering the number of properties that may be unreasonably impacted by increased risk of flooding and tidal storms versus the sole private benefit of constructing a residence for Ms. Regan, we believe the proposed public-private benefits to the project clearly do not outweigh the public-private detriments. Based upon the comments in the record, at least two members of the board used the proposed on-site mitigation and the assessment of in-lieu mitigation fees to justify their approval of the proposed impacts. We can only assume that the other three members that voted to approve the project similarly allowed the mitigation component to influence their decisions. It is important to note that the Commission's wetland mitigation compensation policy strictly states that, in quote, since the proposed activity should stand on its own merits in the permit approval process, compensation should not be used to justify permit issuance, end quote. Furthermore, the board failed to fully evaluate and account for all of the potential impacts that may result from the development requirements from other city departments. Their approval represents a blank check to the applicant, since it allows the project to be significantly modified to accommodate those requirements without further consideration by the board. The potential requirements from the city's public works, utilities, and fire departments will more than likely fail to consider or seek to avoid wetland impacts. In the opinion of staff, the Norfolk Wetlands Board in this case failed to fulfill their responsibilities under the Wetland Zoning Ordinance by authorizing the despoilation and destruction of tidal wetlands within their jurisdiction. The project is clearly not water dependent, and on that basis alone should have been denied without further consideration pursuant to the Commission's Wetlands Mitigation Compensation Policy. Furthermore, staff sees no circumstance in which residential housing can demonstrate its need to be developed in wetlands, nor that the public and private benefits of this project outweigh the public and private detriments, as is required by the policy. Staff believes that any decision outside of denial would be non-compliant with the intent of the state's wetland zoning ordinance and the commission's above-referenced regulation, and would set a dangerous precedent to allow residential development within wetlands throughout all of Tidewater. In light of the foregoing and in accordance with Section 28.2.13.13.1 of the Code of Virginia, staff recommends the commission reverse the decision of the Norfolk Wetland Board, finding that the board failed to fulfill its responsibilities under the wetland zoning ordinance. Staff feels that a reversal rather than a remand to the board is warranted in this case, since the project is clearly non-water dependent and should not be permitted. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I believe that the city, as well as the appellants, are represented here today, as well as Ms. Regan and her agent and attorney.
Questions? First, Mr. Schick, then Mr. Fox. Mr. Schick.
Do you concur with Norfolk staff in saying that the court case, I guess it was cited in their testimony in 1994, is a good court case for us to reference in this case, similar situations?
Mr. Schick, can I defer that to counsel, if I could, please, to respond?
Sure. Counsel has not looked at that case, so can't respond to the present time.
Okay. Proceed.
No, I think it is appropriate. In fact, VMRC staff did provide that case information to city staff prior to the meeting for their own knowledge, so that they could use that in making their own assessments. It was something that we were aware of and felt was a good decision in the past. And just to make the correction, it was 1984, not 1994, Mr. Schick, just for the record, I believe.
Oh, okay, because it says 84 in the...
Right, 84. You believe you said 94. Just
oh, okay.
I just want to make sure the record was clear.
And one follow-up.
Mr. Schick.
The staff's assessment with VIMS is that it is type 1 wetlands that are available there.
You're asking for VMRC staffs?
Yeah, and do you concur with VIMS on that? Or
I'm not sure that I have the ability to question
VIMS on that.
On that Ms. Pam Mason, who was the representative from VIMS who did the on-site inspection, is here today, in addition to Mr. Varnell.
Okay. Want that question answered now?
Yeah, as long as it's up.
Who would you defer? You?
Pam?
Pam, were you sworn this morning? Okay, come forward, please. Identify your name for the record, please, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Pam Mason with the Virginia Institute of Marine Science.
Respond to Mr. Schick's question.
The question was the type of wetlands in NFI?
Is it type 1, or I guess the applicants were saying it was more type 4?
Okay, well, so in the wetlands guidelines, we actually have 1 through 17 types, and then they're grouped, so in order of sort of ecological significance. So the type I would call would be type 2, which is salt meadow. And that's basically, it's an assessment of the majority of the vegetation on site. They're all salt bushes on site. But in the description of the wetlands guidelines of type 2, it says that salt bushes can be associated with that type. So it's sort of an upper end mix, if you will. And then as far as the group that's in, I believe it's group 2 in terms of ecological importance.
And you would call that primary ecological significance?
We don't actually use that terminology. We actually talk about the specific ecosystem services of a type of wetland. And a high marsh type wetland has primary production, you know, high levels of primary production that go into the food chain for the estuarine marine resources. It has capacity to hold some tidal flooding waters, you know, in other words, buffer some tidal flooding. It has some capacity to filter pollutants from runoff. All wetland vegetation is actually fairly efficient at removing pollutants, nutrients, and whatnot from runoff. And I have one comment to make in terms of wetland vegetation and its presence on the site. Wetlands vegetation is actually fairly non-competitive as a type of vegetation. And if upland vegetation were intended to be there by nature, it would, because the wetlands vegetation actually won't outcompete the Bermuda grass in this case.
So in proper elevation for upland vegetation, Bermuda grass would overtake.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Not vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if
Mr. Schick,
if that area was low lying, but it hadn't had introduction of salt water because of the buffer area being higher, and it had Bermuda grass, and then the city did come in and make that area, would then take over the Bermuda grass if that in fact was there prior, if it was lower area.
It's really the elevation that's right. Critical. The Desiccalus has the ability to deal with the salt and the flooding, and the Bermuda grass doesn't.
Right.
So it's inherently indicative of low, salty,
right.
Flooded waters, because that's where it can grow.
So low elevation without salt water wouldn't have necessarily these types of wetlands.
If the low elevation have hydrology, it might have tidal freshwater plants,
right.
That you guys also have. Different plants, but still wetland plants.
So in summing up, and then I'll finish, that you feel that this is a functional, valuable wetlands area?
Yes.
Further questions? Ms. Mason? I'm sorry, Dr. McConaughey.
Is it possible that this was grass before and due to increased tidal height?
It's very possible. I'm not familiar with how old the bulkhead is and how frequently it's been maintained. The bulkhead top elevation is quite low. Okay, so when the tide is out, it makes it look like the bulkhead's really tall, but it's actually a very short feature. I don't know exactly what the top elevation is. But yes, it's very possible. And just my perception of that whole landscape is that my guess would have been that there was originally some dredging and fill behind the bulkhead, so that elevation would have been raised higher. Whenever. I'm going to say maybe the 50s or 60s. I don't actually know the age of the original bulkhead. And it probably would have been more like a lawn. And then sea level rise, even over that period of time, over like, let's say that's 30 or 40 years, would have had an effect too.
Further questions? Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. McGinnis?
Yes.
Mr. Fox?
Does Ms. Reagan's land go to the water? It does not. It goes to the right-of-way.
It goes to the right-of-way. She's separated by the right-of-way from the water.
And then between the right-of-way and the bulkhead, whose land is that? The city's?
The city has the right-of-way to the bulkhead, is my understanding.
Okay.
One quick question, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
That is the city's right-of-way that stops right there, what appears to be roughly paved. At the very top of the picture?
Top, that's correct.
And those vehicles that are there, is that used now for, it looks like a walkway that walks right to the city's right-of-way, and
I can't say that this portion here is was developed by the city. This may just be a driveway portion for this house at the terminus of the road.
If you don't know, you don't know. That's fine.
I can't say from this photograph, and I haven't been to that side of the road before. So.
Further questions of Mr. McGinnis? Thank you, Ben. Is the appellant here or represented?
The appellant is asking.
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry.
Forward. Good morning, ma'am. Raise your right hand. Solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, except for God.
I do.
You state your name, please.
Nicole Sanford.
Okay, Ms. Sanford.
I live at 1228 Manchester. My house is directly behind Ms. Regan's three parcels of property. I don't have a pointer, but it's a white house, the house that Ms. Regan grew up in. Right there. It's my house.
Okay.
My concern with the property is the tidal flooding. My husband and I have lived in the house for the past 7.5 years, and the flooding is crazy, to say the least. The road on Manchester, as well as Richmond Place, coming up here, all along here, and her property, Manchester Avenue here, and all along here. The flooding that occurs on a regular basis, I'm not talking just in a hurricane, I'm talking on a above the normal tide, the moon. You can't park your cars in the street. You can't drive around the corner. You can't walk down the street. The property serves as a tidal barrier, as the staff has noted. The wetlands do their job. They protect the surrounding houses. My house, as well as I think five other houses surrounding the properties on along Manchester, have basements. I can't control that my existing property has a basement and the flooding could then go into my house. You take away wetlands that are doing their job as a protective tidal barrier, where's the water going to go? During a storm, that property fills up like a pond, like a lake you saw from the pictures. I like that it does that because it's out of my house. It's not going into my house and the other properties. And that is my major concern, is the tidal flooding. I don't want it getting any worse. And every storm, it gets a little worse. It's just the nature of the property.
Thank you, Ms.
If you have any questions, yeah. My letter is page 2, I believe. Of
I think we may have some questions from members of the commission. Mr. Tankard?
The photograph, September 24th, 2008.
Yes.
What event was that?
That was, just a storm. That was above the normal high tide. I don't even think it was considered a nor'easter. Was it a nor'easter? Okay, it was a nor'easter.
Okay.
Of this fall.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, ma'am.
Okay.
Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Morning. My name's Alfred. Oh.
You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So, yeah.
I do.
Your name, please.
My name is Alfred Magnus, M-A-G-N-E-S-S. And we are the, my wife and I live in the brown house that you see in the photograph up there. We signed the petition, but we did not go to the original commission meeting, to a large extent, because we were shown this overwhelming amount of evidence by the, professional staff of the wetlands violations. I'm here to speak against the development of the property, and I do so somewhat reluctantly because I've known Carol for many, many years, my wife and I have, and we knew her when she and her mother lived in this house originally, and they were very amiable neighbors, and we certainly bear no grudge. We are, however, against development of this area. Whole wetlands story, I think, needs to be taken in somewhat a historical context. We bought this house in 1980. It was originally built in the 1970s, and when we moved in, nobody really had much in the way to say. You never even heard the word wetlands come up. It was not really discussed as such. We knew the area did flood, and allegedly our floor was 1 foot higher than the highest tide recorded in the area, and our house is on piles. This road that you see down to the left there
Mr. Magnus?
Yes.
I've been informed by counsel very accurately, so if you were not at the hearing,
yes.
Basically if you're providing new testimony, we're opening the record, I would like for you to please limit your comments to what was mentioned today and frame your opposition or support in light of what's been mentioned today.
I will definitely try and do that. But I do need to say a couple of things. One...
Please be careful, because I don't want to rule you out of order.
Right, okay. Well, if I'm out of order, just tell me.
Okay.
Just tell me. This driveway is not city-maintained. It's gravel, and I maintain it. It was there when we bought the house, as was this walkway. The other thing that has been said this morning, but let me make sure I get it in before it's not said, is the question of whether the alteration of the bulkhead created the wetlands. And having lived in this area a long time, I can say that that what we did the same thing as everybody in this area. We mowed this whole area right down to the bulkhead originally. The city came through and repaired the bulkhead, but what they did was they repaired cracks in the bulkhead. They didn't elevate it. And the tides have not changed. They came in there massively before the bulkhead was altered and have still come in there because the height has not been altered. It was only cracks, and so the area doesn't drain as well as it used to when there were cracks in the bulkhead. But, again, the city did this on their own. In any event, once Irene sold her property, this is the mother, she sold the property, she divided it up so that presumably tried to make a little extra money off this back property, but was never able to sell it. I don't think I'm out of order. Am I out of order?
You're approaching it.
Approaching it. In any event, it was never sold, and Carol is trying to develop this now. We actually went out after an article came out in the paper about 10 years ago about wetlands. There was some poor man who was going to trim a bush in his lawn, and the commission was going to charge him $1,000. So at that point, we on our own decided that we should not mow that portion of the lawn because we didn't want to end up like this other man. And so the first was about 20 feet there that are not mown, and at the same time, these other property owners did the same. And nothing much more happened with all this until several months ago when I think it's Seamus, one of the people from the Wetlands Committee came around, and he told us that Carol was planning to develop this site, and he showed us this long list from the commission of objections, and so we couldn't imagine how anybody could build with that set of objections. But he also told us that we should stop mowing this portion of the lawn, which we have done since then. And I guess one of our main questions is if we can't even mow our lawn, and the same thing has been told to this neighbor, by the way, how the total, in which case we're just mowing the lawn, not just destroying the wetlands. Building another property is just totally destroying the wetlands. In any event, our main concern is that, not with particularly Carol, but with development, this whole area is basically going to result in total wetlands destruction. And if it's done, if she's given an exemption for this, then everybody has to be given an exemption. What's to prevent everybody else, or for that matter, any other developer, any other place, to be not given the same exemption? And as I say, the words that came screaming out in the paper were "Save the Bay, Save the Bay, Save the Bay," and so we're going sort of against that. So I guess the big thing is that we want to see the law applied uniformly. If we've got to do this, we feel that all the property owners should have to do the same. The other thing is that I'm certainly no expert on wetlands, but I say, given the massive amount of evidence that we were shown by the board when they came through, it's hard to believe that the commission would just throw all that out. So, yeah, those are the main things I think need to be said. And once again, to emphasize that this, it was the height of this bulkhead that was not changed, and so the area flooded long before the city came in.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Madden.
Thank you.
Any other freeholder? Yes, sir. Raise your right hand. Solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, whole truth, not the truth, except for God.
I do.
State your name, please.
Herbert Sampson. I also live in the property there. I was not present at the October meeting because I was deployed overseas.
Okay.
Though I did send the letter initially,
right,
put in there, so
yeah.
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk or not.
You're allowed to talk and explain to us what your concerns are based on what's been testified to today. That's what you can.
Okay.
So basically, and we've heard a lot of.
I can stay in that box and I won't be long.
All right, sir. Thank you.
One of the questions that come up earlier about how often did a flood and what events take place that cause this to flood. And it's nothing special. I can tell you that it doesn't have to be a nor'easter. The news isn't going to tell you, hey, tidal flooding expected. It just shows up. It really is dependent upon a full moon. It really helps if it's a full moon to have a flood. But it really is a nor'east wind, and if it's a blowing nor'east wind, it's going to flood. And some of the slides you saw earlier on in there, you could actually see where parts of docks and bulkheads and other parts of floats and the floats to the ocean or in the bay actually ends up all the way up to our property, because it increases significantly just prior to the end of the current Davis property. So the pictures of 30 years ago, things have changed in 30 years. We're not the same tidal levels we used to be. It floods much more regularly than it ever did. So it's something to be expected. And to BAFTA to have a house there, it's going to be a hard process. You're going to have to put in a lot of fill to keep that. And it talks about having a basement underneath the property. I mean, it's not a basement. A garage underneath the property with some fill. It's going to cover a significant portion. And now that water is going to go somewhere else. And if they're going to make a downland or downgrade the back corner of the lot, that's just going to end up being a swamp. And I'm not necessarily in the mood to have a mosquito growing breeding area right in the back. Because the way the wetlands works, tide goes in, tide goes out. It stays marshy, but you got a lot of vegetation and a lot of wildlife that works through the area all the time. That's all going to change, and I'm just going to end up with a swamp in the back. So, hope the board would consider that and consider what the laws state, and not what the empathy of some of the.
Thank you, sir. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else in opposition to this project? Mr. James?
Thank you, Mr. Bowman.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So, Mr. Brother, the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, self you God.
I do.
State your name for the record, please, sir.
My name is Ellis W. James. I'm a lifelong resident of the city of Norfolk at 2021 Kenley Place. I just wanted to touch on a couple of things very quickly. You've heard a lot of testimony. I've had the privilege of sitting through the staff presentation in Norfolk, as well as now your staff presentation. This project should never have gone forward. And as I indicated in my opposition in Norfolk at the Wetlands Board hearing, at some point we have to make a decision about whether or not we are going to try to deal with the loss of wetlands, as the commission has a responsibility in that area, and you've heard me address that here before you on several occasions. I coincidentally happen to grow up in this area. I used to go there where the wetlands were. I grew up on Powhatan Avenue, but my friends and I used to roam in bateaus up into the areas along the shorelines. This is another strategic loss of wetlands in an area that cannot afford it. The whole area, not just this property, but the whole area that we're looking at is being impacted. And with climate change that is now obviously dramatically underway, our city, my city, needs to begin to make decisions that will help address those problems. And this is a classic example of where the commission can do its work and do what really is right. Thank you, Mr. James.
Thank you, Mr. James. Any questions, Mr. James? Thank you, sir. Anyone else in opposition to the project? Okay. Is Ms. Reagan present or represented? Good morning, sir. How are you, Stacy?
For the record, my name is Carl Eason. I'm with the law firm of Walcott Rivers Gates. I've got Mr. Giorgio with me and the applicant to respond to questions. My background is I was a clerk at the Supreme Court of Virginia, and you'd think I'd know the difference between an appellant and an appellee by now, so I stood at the wrong time, forgive me. And oftentimes I'm on the other side of the coin. But let me give you a little bit of background on this. I, too, am not a stranger to this lot, because Carol's mother came to me back in 1997, 1998, and wanted to develop it at that time. She's passed now, and by inheritance, the lot is now passed on to Carol. But a nationwide permit, 3, was granted by the Corps of Engineers back then for the construction of a residence. She had that vested right. She let that permit expire during her illness and infirmity, and Carol now comes to restore that opportunity to try to build a home on the site. Nobody brings that up because at that point in time, and it's in the record below, if you look, we had the Corps of Engineers come out on 2 separate occasions to do wetlands delineations for us. The one in 1997, the two permits that were pending, one was for the construction of the single-family residence of Carol's mother. The second application that was pending was by the city of Norfolk, and that was to come in and actually denude adjacent to the bulkhead and do some repair and replacement. The nationwide permit, three at that time, by two separate Corps of Engineer delineators, found around 1,000 square foot of marsh immediately adjacent to a narrow band on that bulkhead. Here I stand before you 10 years later, looking at a photograph of what my expert tells me is a Class 3 or Class 4 type, what your Norfolk Wetlands Board tells you is a moderate at best, not a primary, and I'm thinking, how could the creation of these wetlands have gotten to this extent? And so when I started looking at the project, and you look at your record, you'll see that there was an outfall pipe that the city installed, and you'll see that that outfall pipe is no longer operative, and it's allowed water to back up in there. But the main thing that I want you to focus upon is if you go back to the slide that the staff of VMRC showed you, it said planted wetlands. They planted the wetlands. So Ms. Regan had a buildable lot. She had a nationwide permit number 3 granted, and the city came in, and there is no doubt it's stipulated. It's city property for 50 feet from that bulkhead landward. They planted a wetland. The first thing that strikes me as counsel is I learned back at UVA and Williams and Richmond Law School, you can't landlock property. That's forbidden. You must allow access, ingress, and egress to it. And landlocked properties are something that, of course, can be redressed by the court. If you plant wetlands throughout the entirety of that 50-foot easement, then you say you can't mow it and you can't develop it, one would wonder whether that approach is a taking. Now, there is a case that's cited here. There's two cases that I read before coming here today, and one was a case that's called City of Virginia Beach versus Hall, and that was a case that obviously was decided in my jurisdiction, and the court determined there was no taking by a regulation and by the exercise of the application of the ordinance, and it was the wetlands ordinance there. In that particular case, however, one of the things that the court looked at was that the acquisition of the property was subsequent to the enactment of the ordinance. So it's almost like saying, Carl, the house is burning. Be careful when you run in there. You ought to know that it's burning before you buy it. The history in this particular lot, which is distinguishable, is the lot was subdivided and platted in 1909. We come forward to Ms. Regan's acquisition of it in 1966. Your wetlands ordinance, of course, came around in 1972. And then we have her as late as 1998 in the possession of a buildable permit. And so I think if you look at it from you can't develop your property, you can't have ingress and egress through a city street because we built a marshland of whatever nature, whether it be of modest or low or primary, then you can't landlock it. That may be a distinction. And trying to decide, and I'm sure Mr. Josephson will tell you, is that a good case for us to rely upon? And these types of cases, I think it's all about the exercise of judgment. I think it's a balancing. And I think the courts look at these types of cases on a case-by-case basis. And so while we derive general principles from the state code or from our guidelines and application, I think it really turns into somewhat of an equitable balancing when the court looks at the parties and the parameters involved. The Hall versus VMRC case that was cited earlier also was Judge Russo. I knew Judge Russo when he was active there and quite a man to appear in front of. And he said, you can't stop the application of the property for its ordinary purpose. What does he mean by ordinary purpose in that case? If we were trying to build a marina here, I could easily come in and say, wow, that's a water punt activity or a boathouse or something like that. This is a residential structure. When he speaks to you shall not prohibit it from its natural uses, let's look at what the natural uses are for this lot. It's in Norfolk. It's zoned for a single-family residence. That is the only permitted use. And so I suggest to you that that needs to also be taken into consideration as well as the artificial creation of the wetlands. In reviewing a case, the first thing I try to look to is I look to, number one, did all the procedures and process and opportunities of due process and notice to be heard be given? And the answer, I think, here is yes. And the second thing I look to is the Wetlands Board in the city of Norfolk is a learned body. I've appeared there many times. They exercise good judgment, and we grant them a certain amount of discretion and decision-making power. And I don't think that we sit, meaning the commission as a whole here,
as a body that reviews something de novo, which means a new trial. We're not reopening the record day. We're not taking new evidence. We're looking at the testimony that was before them, and then we have to decide, did they apply the principles of the law correctly, and is this, if it ever found its way to a circuit court, something that we can sustain based upon what's in the record? Well, the city of Norfolk, just like Virginia Beach and other jurisdictions, has the benefit of counsel appearing, and Cindy Hall did appear, and she read to them relevant portions of 4911, which, of course, is the city wetlands ordinance. But she went further than that. She also commended to the Wetlands Board in Norfolk 28.2.1308, and you'll see that the record shows on page 62 that they were instructed relative to the appropriate standards, the applicability of the code, and the guidelines to follow. She told them they had three charges, and the three charges were to follow the mandates of 4911, follow the mandates of the Virginia Code, balance the private benefit versus the private public versus private benefit versus detriment argument, and third and lastly, she said to make sure that the purposes of this act are fulfilled. So having gone through that, then my analysis turns to, let's look at the project in and of itself on this record and see whether we think it comports with the statute. And the first threshold issue we have to get to, of course, is wetlands. Stay out of them as the rule. And certainly you shall not fill if you determine their primary ecological significance. VIMS comes here, and they don't characterize projects such as that. And I think that, if I'm not mistaken, they said this was probably a Type 2 project. The record also, however, supports Mr. Giorgio's determination that it's a Type 3 or 4 and of a lesser significance. Then that decision-making gets exercised by the Norfolk Wetlands Board, and based upon the information before it, it makes a decision as to what's there and what's appropriate. And they determined that it was not of primary ecological significance. At best, if we look at the record, and I think on about page 79, the impact is modest and the wetlands are of a low grade. And so we leave 28.2.1308 subsection 1 and we go to 2. And that presumes that some development would be allowed, just as the development was allowed 10 years ago as I stood before regulatory bodies. It says development to the maximum extent practicable. Practicable is the word to focus upon there. That means reasonable, and that means to apply the standards in a fashion such that you weigh that public-private benefit. To deprive this lady of the development rights of a lot per se that her mother achieved 10 years ago with an intervening planting of a wetland without further consideration and with an outfall pipe backing up into the property creating the impoundments of water, I don't think is the rigid application of the statute and ordinance that's mandated by the spirit and the policy of the code. The second thing as we turn to is the objections that have been brought by the freeholders here, and they say you haven't followed the standards. This doesn't meet the water dependency test. Well, if we're talking about shoreline stabilization, which is an example that's given in the guidelines, it's very easy to apply. We all know what riprap revetment is, and we all know what an appropriate 3-to-1 slope is, and we know how far to keep our piers above the wetlands to allow sufficient penetration of light so as to preserve them. But if you read that application as a rigid, non-practical form, then you just say absolutely anything that's not water development or water dependent shall never be ruled by any board or by this commission as permitted. And that's not the case, and that's not what the history of this board's ruling or of the Norfolk Wetlands Board's rulings do. What did the board consider? In the record, if you read it, and it's sort of nice coming to these things sometimes not having been counsel before the Wetlands Board, it's almost nice coming to it as though I used to come to a case as a law clerk. You're looking at a cold record and you're going, what's in there to support or not support the record? I found this. We have considered the economic impact. We have considered the applicant's minimization of impacts. We have considered the impact is modest. We consider the wetlands of a low grade. We consider the fact that this was platted in 1999, taxed as a buildable lot. We consider that it was acquired in 62 and the prior permits that were granted on it. They considered maximum mitigation on site, and they also considered the fact that there is no development and the proposed mitigation is on one of her three lots to allow it. One of the things that was suggested at the Wetlands Board is, why don't you go try to get a variance? And if you look at the site plan that was up there, there's a very mature, huge magnolia tree. Magnolia trees, of course, being very, very slow growing by nature and something that you don't want to disturb. I don't think that the code requires us to go try and build a structure on a zero lot line. This structure, however, is pushed as far back landward as it possibly can so as not to violate the City of Norfolk zoning code. It likewise, if you look at that 50-foot street, there is a suggestion in the record that you might have to develop the entirety of the street. Your Wetlands Board considered it, said if that's the case, come back to us, and we'll deal with it again at that point. But for now, the application minimizes the development in the right-of-way, and it pushes the narrow driveway maximum amount that it possibly can on a channelward basis. To deny any development or even the absence of mowing or allowing ingress and egress to that property, I don't think meets the spirits of the wetlands guidelines, and I do think that it does approach the issue, at least in my mind, of whether that deprives the landholder, Ms. Reagan, of her rights. The Corps of Engineer delineations are something that was in the record. When you're the trier of fact and you're to be making a discretionary call, you're allowed to determine Mr. Giorgio's credibility and his input that was valuable. You're allowed to speak to and look at what Kevin's input was and its value, VIMS, the Corps of Engineers, and the prior deliberations. And when you have all that before you, then as a Norfolk Wetlands Board member, you evaluate it. But the main thing that's reversible error is not to have considered those factors. To have considered those factors and to come to a decision that's at variance, reasonable men can differ. Reasonable men can come to different conclusions based upon the same evidence. But the question is, do we supplant our judgment and sit as a body de novo over them, or do we find out whether the record supports what they did appropriately, and we affirm if the record is supportive that they've considered the factors? Now, I also think that you need to look at the minimization of the project, both in the terms of the footprint of the house vis-a-vis what other is adjacent. It's on an 1,800 square foot footprint. The size of the driveway has been minimized, the length of the driveway to the extent possible by accessing it from Richmond Point as opposed from the other area minimizes the amount of that impact. And I think that the creation of on-site development, although that 20-foot lot only has a very small portion that's outside of a delineated wetland, even according to our evidence, that's still allowed for the on-site mitigation to be maximized. I certainly don't wish to sit down without saying that probably the least type of mitigation that's favorable to the Norfolk Wetlands Board or any wetlands board in this commission is an in-lieu type mitigation. You want to avoid it. If you can't avoid it, you want to do it on site. If you can't do it on site, certainly try to get me in the same estuary. And if you can't get me in the same estuary, then allow that to be considered. But the code knows that all situations are not rigid. And the drafters of our law said those will be an appropriate consideration if all other practical alternatives have been exhausted. And $40,000 or $50,000 of in-lieu compensation is not a de minimis amount by any stretch of the imagination, at least not to me. This is not filling to create a waterfront lot. This isn't a waterfront lot. The City of Norfolk owns the waterfront in front of this property. This is not filling to achieve that purpose, as the record would demonstrate, and as some have argued. There is some upland filling. There is also some upland grading and downsizing. It's a question of the application of reason. There's been some statement that there was a failure to minimize the permanent impacts. And in that regard, I would cite to you that this project took perhaps a little bit more of a curious or circuitous route through the City of Norfolk than did others. You'll see that there was input sought from fire or rescue or public utilities, etc. Those are usually things that happen in the site plan review after you take the site plan and you deal with the wetlands issues. But that's okay. I don't take exception with that. Might need to develop the road? Come back before the Wetlands Board if we try to build at variance with our site plan. Might need to try to minimize the impact by trying to get a variance. That's something that can be dealt with by the city at a regulatory stage and in the site review process. So I suggest to you that what you have now is an applicant whose mother, 10 years ago, enjoyed a buildable lot, got a nationwide permit number 3 with de minimis wetlands being involved in it. and then you see a denuded photograph adjacent to where the Norfolk, city of Norfolk construction was done. And I'm not trying to make the city a monster for the creation of wetlands. Only if they try to create it in my sole ingress and egress in front of my house, which is my only access to my buildable lot. But then we see the evolution of the wetlands, and we see the failure to maintain the outfall pipe. I think that if the property in its natural state were such as we see a photograph, that would give me some pause for concern. If I see property that has been altered by man to create an artificial state, and then we argue that that's a protection of a natural resource, one might question the applicability of the word natural. I don't think that too much weight was applied by the Norfolk Wetlands Board to the fact that this is a taxable, buildable lot. We all have a tax rate that we enjoy, or I'm not sure that enjoy was the right word to use in that case, that we all have imposed upon our properties that we sustain. And certainly a suggestion that a relief of an applicant before a wetlands board is to not develop their property and go get a tax rebate is not one that I would advocate as being a reasonable alternative. I have Mr. Giorgio to address any of the technical aspects, and I'd like him to be able to address the commission. But first, I'd like to offer an opportunity to respond to any inquiries or questions that you might have of me.
Any questions of Mr. Easton, Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question. Are you suggesting that the existence of a basically now expired Army Corps permit from the 1990s in some way conveys a right to build on the lot irrespective of actual on-site conditions?
No, if you acquire a permit and you sit on your permit rights and you allow them to expire, then they expire. I'm merely trying to give a historical progression of the lot and curious how we would look 10 years ago and see no wetlands whatsoever and an evaluation done as to the existence of normal wetlands at that time versus what we see there now. But it does not. Once it's expired, that's not the grounds.
Mr. Tankard?
Further, are you also testifying that Mr. Giorgio of JSG Development Corporation, or Consultants, excuse me, is a expert in wetlands?
I'll let Mr. Giorgio identify his credentials for the records if I could defer to that to him.
Okay.
I think it was testimony before the board, and I think that the Norfolk Wetlands Board can hear testimony from many different sources, be they expert or be they not. The question then becomes, in the exercise of their discretion, just as with you, you assign different weights to that testimony. And someone who has particular expertise in a given area, such as a formal training or 20 years experience, that testimony may in fact be more weighty than a layperson who comes in and says, oh, I see districula there, or tries to identify marsh grass for you. It's a question of weight, not excludability or includability.
Mr. Schick?
When you were referring to the wetlands and their the quality of the wetlands, was that from the Army Corps assessment or was that from a VIMS assessment? You could review that. You said there was a report in this in our packet on a page. I didn't catch the page number.
I didn't say there was a report. If I might, there were two things. You have the VIMS report in there that speaks to the characterization of the type of vegetation that's there. And it types them, and I think it was a type 2. Mm-hmm. It doesn't call them wetlands of primary ecological significance, which is a verbiage that you find in the code.
Right.
The reference that I gave you in the transcript was, I think, to page 67. I can check
right,
very
67,
quickly.
Right.
79, approximately 79. And there is a discussion and after hearing of the evidence and after deliberating, a statement that I recall, and I don't have it in front of me the second, by DeShields that says that his determination is the wetlands are of a low grade, and I think the quote is low grade.
Further questions?
All right. I thank the members of the commission for your consideration. I will yield the floor to Mr. Giorgio.
Okay.
Good morning.
Raise your right hand. Solemn swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I will.
State your name, please, for the record.
James Giorgio, JSG Development Consultants, Norfolk.
Okay.
I'm the agent for the applicant.
Okay. Mr. Schick had a question about your qualifications. As far as an expert in wetlands delineation identification, can you start by setting the table with that, please?
Sure. I am I'm a licensed professional engineer. I have over 22 years of practice in civil engineering, particularly with the environmental-related projects. Now, I'm not a state-certified wetland scientist and hadn't presented myself as being one. In the original testimony before the Wetlands Board, I contended that the wetlands, due to the nature of the predominant vegetation where the house and the driveway portion of the part of the driveway immediately in front of the house, which really represented the vast majority of the impact, was at an elevation considerably higher than what the wetlands guidelines identify as a type 1 or type 2. The elevation of the bulkhead, the top of the bulkhead, is approximately about 1.4 feet higher than mean high water. The mean low and mean high water line fall along the face of that bulkhead, and the guidelines state that the classification, when they discuss the physiographic location of type 1 and type 2, it's defined as being landward to approximately mean high or the spring tide line, which is that elevation does not go above the level of the bulkhead. And the fact that most of the wetlands that you see in the area, the photograph, I mean, albeit within the right-of-way, most of it is disticulous. But the vast majority of it, landward, where the house and the majority of the impact will be, is in fact emergent saltbush. And it emerges very, very quickly, considering that the property was mowed up until June 2007, and within a year, when those photographs that were taken by me that were presented in the record, you see how quickly that salt bush can develop in just a little over a year, given that if it wasn't being mowed. And all of that elevation is on the property itself, where the house is going to be built, is more than 1.5 feet, about roughly 1.6 feet on average, higher than the elevation of mean high water. And it should be noted too that we actually conducted a detailed tide study on this site over a 3-month period to determine the tide patterns in determining where the jurisdictional limits of the city wetlands board is, that 269 contour that you heard of. And so all this information is current, up to date, takes into account changes in rising sea level and such. And so that's, I present myself as certainly an expert in that regard. I don't hold myself out to be a wetland scientist.
Questions?
Question.
Yep, Mr. Taggart.
Mr. Giorgio, you also have stated in your testimony that allowing the property not to be developed would constitute a taking by the government. Are you a legal expert as well?
No, I'm not. I'm a civil engineer, licensed civil engineer. However, that was my contention that if they're denied the access to the property through a public right-of-way, which sure Mr. Eason can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe there is a legal distinction between a public right-of-way and fee simple owned property by the city. That right-of-way was dedicated by the original development of Larchmont in 1909. Those lots have been platted since 1909. And they are being taxed at the same rate and the same land value as the two adjoining properties that have residences on them already. And that was part of the record. I presented that to the Wetlands Board, that the land value component of the assessment is on par with the adjacent properties that have houses on them already. And so that was my point, in that if you convert what was a non-wetland undeveloped street, and the city of Norfolk actually alters the terrain, introduces wetlands vegetation, it converts it to a wetland. Further, there was an outfall pipe that used to stub through the bulkhead, and it was just an open end daylighted pipe, a little hole behind the bulkhead. That pipe has been filled in and is no longer functioning. I mean, what my contention was that the city, you know, basically created conditions to create a wetland, and in 10 years, this is what we have. That's their only legal access to the property through what is a public right-of-way. The city has in the past, and we believe will in the future, you know, grant driveway permits to allow homeowner to put in a minimum amount of driveway necessary to get access to the property. I mean, we didn't propose a full city street because we were operating we were trying to minimize the wetlands. And so as we presented to the board, we feel like this is a viable project. We'd like to come before the wetlands board showing the minimum, absolute minimum impact. We maintain the narrow width, kept it as landward as we possibly can, and maintain the grade of it equal to what is there now to allow for any continued tidal flooding or any wetlands that could have been upland of where the right-of-way is, which we didn't delineate. So we feel we met the standard.
A follow-up question, if we could. I didn't read in the testimony that was given at the original hearing about this pipe you speak of. Was that in there somewhere?
I referred to it in my original testimony, and I pointed out on the photographs. You could see it, and you can't actually see the pipe, but you can see this depressed area in the background of some of the old photographs, and it is shown on the city's record drawings that actually when they repaired the bulkhead, oddly enough, when they repaired the bulkhead, they removed an old steel pipe, 12-inch culvert that stubbed through the wall. They actually removed it and replaced it with a 12-inch diameter PVC pipe, and then buried the end of it for some reason. And so it's not functioning.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Giorgio. Ms. Reagan, did you want to testify? Were you going to testify? Mr. Easton, are you leading the case at this time? Who else are you going to have testify?
That would be the conclusion, unless members of the commission would like to advance any questions of Ms. Reagan.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Curtis, is the Wetlands Board here represented? Norfolk Wetlands Board? Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you.
I'm Charles Stanley Prentice for the Deputy City Attorney. Substitute counsel for the Wetlands Board.
I did not really realize you remember the bar, sir. I'm sorry. Did you have any comments or any questions?
I would not have any comments. I would tell the commission that I do have a member of the Wetlands Board here, Mr. Giannata, as well as one of the city staff answering the questions that the commission may have.
Okay. Thank you so much. Any questions from the commission? Mr. Schick.
Yes, is somebody from the staff or Wetlands Board? Mr. Robbins, in his comments on page 79, about line 20 or so, talks about low-grade wetlands. I wanted to have them expand upon that. Was that Mr. Robbins' opinion? Was that something that was introduced as evidence? How did that conclusion come to light? And I'd like to.
Okay, Councilor for the Wetlands Board, do you have any city staff here as well that could respond to that? All right, I didn't see you behind the podium, sir. My fault.
Smart man.
So I'm swear the testimony you're about to give be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do, sir.
State your name for the record, please.
Kevin DuBois, I'm staff to the Norfolk Wetlands Board. I'm a certified professional wetland scientist since 1995 with the Society of Wetland Scientists, and I'm the seventh certified state professional delineator in the state of Virginia, number seven.
I think he's your man, Kyle.
Yes.
Proceed, Mr. Chick.
Yeah, Mr. Robbins, he's a member of the board. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in his statement on page 79, line 20, talks about the impact is modest in a low-grade wetlands. How was that determined?
I simply believe that was his opinion. Staff presented a different opinion.
That was in staff's opinion of the quality of the wetlands there.
It is a high quality wetlands, and it has existed for quite some time.
Quite some time. On not only at the bulkhead and the 50-foot buffer, but also up into the lot.
That's correct. And staff reported as part of the transcript that that wetland had been there for quite some time. Staff had performed previous delineations for Ms. Reagan's mother, Ms. Davidson, and provided survey delineations to Ms. Davidson prior to this action and prior to the city's work on the seawall.
Now, when the Corps applied its opinion in giving nationwide permits prior, did that go before any of that information go before the Wetlands Board that you know about?
I believe you're referring to the work in the city right-of-way. That's exempt from local Wetlands Board jurisdiction, although city staff was involved in a preliminary assessment to advise the Department of Public Works about the requirements for permits. We delineated as wetlands at that time, and that's why we asked the Department of Public Works to replace wetlands vegetation. I think it's been mischaracterized that the city introduced wetlands vegetation to the site. It was previously wetlands. City staff had delineated it and flagged it as wetlands, and it was just a matter of course that to restabilize this property, that you would have to use wetlands vegetation, just like the wetlands vegetation that was there before, because that is what would exist and would properly stabilize the site. So wetlands vegetation was not introduced, it was just restored. There was wetlands vegetation there prior.
And then I guess one other question, then I'll let somebody else have a shot. The applicant mother had a nationwide permit to build a house. Are you aware of that permit? And how does that reflect on the wetlands issue?
I'll be very frank. I believe that the delineation was not done properly by the Corps of Engineers at the time, but the permit did expire, and we felt it had no bearing on the case.
Right.
Further questions? Mr. Tankard?
Just so I'm a little bit better in my thinking about this, this pipe and when that went away, and thus the drainage of the terrain was changed. Is that what you experienced?
I'm not familiar with the pipe that Mr. Giorgio references, but you saw in the photographs there are existing stormwater pipes on the adjacent streets. If they are a mechanism for water to drain off the site, if they're sited at a particular elevation, they're also a way for water to be introduced to the site. So I would say closing the pipe, you know, you could interpret it that both it changed the drainage, both the flooding characteristic and the drainage characteristic. I mean, the reality is with or without this pipe, the site floods on a regular basis. It supports the hydric soils that define a wetland, and I'll just remind the commission that you don't need to have overland flow for a wetland to be a wetland. A wetland is a wetland because the soils are saturated, and that is not always manifested by overland flooding.
Mr. Tankard?
One more question in your expert opinion. Will introduced wetlands plants survive in upland areas?
There are certain plants, there are certain wetlands plants that will survive in both conditions. One of the salt bushes is a prime example. Bacchus alamifolia is not an obligate wetlands plant, and it can grow in uplands and wetlands. But I will agree with the statement that was made earlier, is that they're not aggressive. You don't have typically like this, you will not have 100% wetlands vegetation moving up into, naturally moving up into upland areas and taking over upland vegetation. I've never seen that happen. The reverse is true.
Further questions?
Yeah,
did you have
further?
Yeah. Go ahead,
Chair. As far as the reverse is true, but also non-functional or low-grade wetlands can encroach and be introduced into primary high-grade wetlands, and that mix can occur
because of man's intervention.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by the introduction of low-grade into high-grade wetlands.
Well, I mean, the spread of other than primary high-grade wetlands can be affected by upland growth of different types of species.
If I understand you correctly, let me explain what I think you mean. What I believe the testimony was before, that Bermuda grass and other upland species can often creep into wetlands of primary ecological significance. That's absolutely the case, especially when properties are mowed repeatedly. Bermuda grass and other upland grasses are specifically designed to be able to survive frequent mowing activity. And when you mow grass, you're cutting it, and that's stressful to plants, so they're genetically engineered to be able to take that type of repeated stress, whereas natural vegetation is not. So you will often have in mowed situations things like Bermuda grass that can tolerate infrequent flooding will creep in and outcompete native wetland species because they're being stressed by artificial conditions such as mowing.
Further questions? I have one. Can you please put the slide back up that delineates the wetlands area showing from, Mr. Du Bois, I need you to stand by if you would, from the shore side to the upland that was measured?
This one here?
No, sir. The one that's the actual picture. The actual stakes with the flags on them.
Okay. Give me 1 second.
All right.
Is this the photo?
That's correct. Okay. Mr. Du Bois, is this the project in question? Does this accurately reflect the project we discussed before the commission today that relates to the decision of the Norfolk Wetlands Board?
That's correct.
The distance or the area between the stake that's in the foreground and the stake in the background, can you describe that for me?
I'd say it's probably between 100 and 200 feet.
In that total area, is that high-value wetlands in your expert opinion?
Yes, sir.
Any further questions in response to mine? Thank you.
You're welcome.
The matter is before the commission for discussion and action. Mr. Eason?
For the record, the reference to the pipe was at page 46, continuing over to page 47. And an indication that the topography was changed, the entire right-of-way was planted with the stickless, and so I forgot who asked that question on it. And also, just from a procedural perspective, I do believe that the record is also clear that there was no evidence before the Norfolk Wetlands Board relative to the delineation or the status from Mr. Du Bois' perspective as of the Corps of Engineers, and so I think that to that extent we've allowed a opening of the record.
In other words, you would like to have the comment pertaining to the accuracy of the Corps' delineation discounted.
I think the Norfolk Wetlands Board asked Mr. Du Bois, do you have any evidence to afford us showing a delineation preceding that, and there was no evidence before him. So to the extent his testimony very eloquently said he didn't agree with their delineation and what the true and accurate scene was, I think we've reopened the record, to which I merely have to take an exception. I commend it to your decision.
Exception noted. Thank you very much.
Just to that point, I just want to point out that item 6V1 in your book is the email correspondence between Norfolk City staff and the Corps pertaining to that earlier delineation where they discuss and the Corps admits they may have made a mistake. So that it was in the record of the hearing, so that may be germane to the comments.
6V1.
6V1.
Thank you, Ben. V, like Victor, I believe. V, Victor?
V is void.
Or B.
V or B?
B or V?
B, B is in Victor. Like in Victor.
Okay. We need a little more paperwork.
For the record, after this case, we're going to take about a 5 to 10 minute recess, and we'll then take up some more of the agenda. Then we'll be taking lunch probably after that case. See how it goes. But if you're not involved in this case, we're going to take a recess again. Matters before the commission for discussion. Mr. Tankard.
I think when we consider 28.2-1313, I believe that the Wetlands Board in reaching its decision failed to fulfill its responsibilities under the Wetland Zoning Ordinance. I believe, in fact, that they put more emphasis on the tax rolls and tax payments and Mr. Giorgio's testimony that there was a taking involved and perhaps some of the laws that they are required to fulfill. I'll begin with that part of my discussion. And I would also like to say that those type of wetlands that you see there on the screen, in my somewhat professional opinion as a nurseryman, and it appears here from this 6V-1 testimony, that there is a significant amount of wetlands and they can exist in conditions that are not conducive to wetlands. So I think that we are given the law of 28.2-1301, the commission is charged with preserving and preventing the despoilations of wetlands while accommodating necessary economic development. So I would ask us to, in our discussion, to remember these two laws that we're charged with considering.
Thank you, Mr. Tankard. Further discussion, Mr. Schick?
Yes, in 28.2-1308, it's very clear that says wetlands of primary ecological significance shall not be altered. Now, it goes on in 2 and talks about, development of Tidewater, Virginia. But that is in a situation where properties have been altered. This obvious situation may have been platted in 1909 to be developed, but what happened in 1909 doesn't apply today. We also see that Army Corps may have given a nationwide permit, but as we've seen in evidence, that the delineation of the wetlands may or mean in suspect for that permit, and the permits have expired. I just don't see where we can continue our ways of error in developing wetlands that are of ecological importance, whether they're type 1, type 2, whatever they may be. This area does serve for importance to protect not only environment but also man-made structures in the area. And I think the application of the mitigation and compensation part of wetlands is completely inappropriate in this part because it is a non-water dependent use. I just feel that you can't mitigate something that shouldn't be done to begin with. So that's my feeling on it. When time comes, I'd like to move to support staff recommendation.
Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see a number of problems with, as staff has already pointed out, with the board's decision. I think the Wetlands Board made some findings of fact that were untethered from the evidence in the record, specifically in the discussion on the motion in formulating its rationale. It was suggested that this was a low-grade wetlands, and I think that's contradicted by
That was contradicted in the record by the VIMS report, which suggested that the species involved were typical of Class 2 or Type 2 wetlands. I think the testimony of their own staff suggested also that these were high-value wetlands, and consequently, I think the board erred in that finding of fact. I think it was also inappropriate to use taxes to justify the decision, that is the tax status or tax history of the property. That's a poor proxy for wetlands delineation. Clearly, we have wetlands here that are of significant ecological importance. And additionally, and perhaps finally, the in-lieu mitigation was used, I think, pretty clearly in the record to justify the decision. That should be the last step and should not serve as a basis for justifying the impact. The Act considers and the Code considers a stepwise approach. I think that's outlined pretty clearly in the guidelines. That is that that you would first determine if the project belongs in the wetlands, if it could be moved out of the wetlands, and then it must be water dependent in nature and demonstrate clearly its need to be in the wetlands. And I don't think any of those requirements have been met in this case, and consequently I think that the board erred in its decision.
Further comments? Mr. Fox?
One of the things the board was supposed to consider was the anticipated public and private benefit of the proposed activity and make sure that that exceeded its anticipated public and private detriment. And I see no evidence in the record that they considered that, unless you would think that they were considering the $12 a square foot as being some public benefit. But absent that, I don't think they considered that issue.
Further discussion? There's a motion on the floor made by Mr. Schick to support staff recommendations to reverse the decision of the Norfolk Wetlands Board. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Robbins. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda is Gregory N. Peck. Oh, what we'll do, 10-minute recess, come back at about 10 minutes to 12, hear that, in all likelihood go to lunch by 12:30.